Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Health Report and Explorations, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome once again to As It Is. You will find us on the internet 7 days a week, ready to help you learn and improve your American English. We do that by speaking a little more slowly and using a limited or fewer number of words to tell you what you need to know. Today, we begin with a story that is very important to those of you in Asia. It concerns three countries that are trying to answer China's increasing claims to the East and South China Seas. Then we will take you to the east coast of the United States, where people are planning for the next major storm. They are asking for advice from experts around the world. Those are the two main stories we have for you today as we look at our world as it is. Now, on to part one. Last week, the President of the Philippines expressed support for a plan by Japan to expand the powers of its military. His announcement was the latest action by China's neighbors to unite against a growing Chinese presence in the East and South China Seas. Ana Mateo joins us to explain the growing diplomatic and military activity in the area.
Three East Asian countries are strengthening their diplomatic and military relationships to strongly answer Chinese territorial claims in the South China Sea. The three countries are Japan, the Philippines, and Vietnam. Eli Ratner is a senior fellow and deputy director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for New American Security, an American-based policy group. He says the three nations are ignoring historic conflicts with each other because of China's aggressive moves.
There's no doubt that countries in the region are collectively spooked by what they're seeing as an increased pattern of Chinese assertiveness from the East China Sea down through the South China Sea.
The past 2 months have been tense. In May, China moved an oil drilling rig into waters that Vietnam claims. A few weeks later, Vietnamese and Philippine troops spent a day together on a disputed island. Neither side made any effort to show it was in control of the island, but both were united in their resistance to China's territorial claims. Last week, Philippine President Benigno Aquino publicly supported a plan by Japan to expand the powers of its military. Japan wants the expanded powers so the military can help allies who are attacked. On Tuesday, the cabinet agreed to ease restrictions on the military. Separately, Japan and the United States have promised to help Vietnam and the Philippines improve their maritime patrol ships. But China shows no signs of backing down. China's defense minister said in May that his country wants a negotiated solution in the South China Sea. Bonnie Glazer is an advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
The Chinese believe that other nations are so economically dependent on China that these other nations will not directly confront China or not do so for a prolonged period, and at the end of the day will accommodate to Chinese interests. So the Chinese think that they have time on their side.
But Eli Ratner says the Chinese government may be mistaken.
I think people often think, well, war is impossible in Asia or conflict is impossible because these economies are so interdependent. But when it comes to these passionate political issues and nationalism, often those considerations get thrown out the door.
After all, he says, England and Germany were major trading partners before the start of World War I. I'm Ana Mateo. This report was based on a story by VOA reporter Victoria Maki.
Nearly 2 years have passed since Hurricane Sandy struck the northeastern United States. Water levels rose almost 4 meters in some areas as the storm moved inland from the Atlantic Ocean. It caused major property damage along the northeast coast. Since then, the federal government has promised $920 million for a program to help plan for the next major storm. The program is called Rebuild by Design. It is bringing together experts on water control from around the world and is welcoming ideas from storm survivors. Jonathan Evans has more.
Hurricane Sandy flooded New York City's famous underground train system, many streets, and buildings. Thousands of people lost electricity, and 60 people died. Now, a team of experts from 11 countries is working on 6 projects to limit damage from the next big storm. Amy Chester is executive director of Rebuild by Design.
The first part that's getting funded is the Lower East Side, and that's East River Park. And they're looking at the park not only as a park, but a berm. So a berm would protect the community, but it would also create a space, create new space for recreation 365 days a year.
A project team called the Big U developed the plan to protect the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Hurricane Sandy flooded much of the area, displacing many families. The recovery is continuing. Bjarke Ingels is a Danish architect who is working on the project.
Think of it as a string of pearls that constantly changes shape and form and character. And for each part of the Big U, we've had intensive meetings with the local communities, and they've told us what they wanted, which things they were missing, which things they were afraid of. And then we've tried to sort of design essentially the flood barrier in a way that it also becomes pavilions for markets or different sort of public amenities.
Damaris Reyes is the executive director of a group called GOALS. Its name comes from the words Gold Old Lower East Side. Ms. Reyes says the Big U design team listened to what she and her neighbors had to say.
They knew that, you know, we were part of this broader coalition that was really representative of community folk, and they came to us and asked to work with us.
The Big U project is the first link in a series of barriers that will protect almost 13 kilometers of the coastline from one side of the city to the other. New York's Staten Island has plans for a fish hatchery, a place where fish can safely grow before they are moved into the wild. Staten Island also has plans for a beach and a harbor school. Wetlands in New York and New Jersey will be improved to reduce the effect of a storm like Sandy. Holly Light is a government administrator who is working on the project. She says she looked all over the world for ideas.
It's much more sophisticated in other parts of the world than it is here right now. And so that element of people who have built real projects for resiliency for other parts of the world and seen what works and what hasn't worked as well, we wanted to tap into that experience and that knowledge base.
Completing the plans may not be the hardest part of the project. The Rebuild by Design team will have to work with federal agencies and city and state governments to get their approval to carry them out. I'm Jonathan Evans.
We have just enough time to learn a bit of history.
If you had been alive in 1937, your local newspaper probably would have had headlines about the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. She was a famous woman pilot who was trying to fly around the world, but somewhere over the Pacific Ocean, her radio went silent. And to this very day, no one knows what happened to her and her assistant, Fred Noonan. And that's it for this edition of As It Is.
The Health Report is next, followed by Explorations. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Beauty is only skin deep. This expression means that beauty is only a temporary surface quality, and some beauty products can cause lasting damage that goes far below the surface of the skin. But people, especially women, will risk a lot for beauty. In the United States, many people use sunlight and non-natural light to darken their skin. Health experts advise against what is called tanning because of its links to skin cancer. In the African country of Senegal, some women take health risks, trying to do just the opposite. They use products that lighten the skin. The World Health Organization says that 25% of Senegalese women use skin lightening products on a usual basis. These products can contain chemicals such as mercury, hydroquinone, and sodium hydroxide. These are dangerous ingredients that can cause cancer and possibly other physical damage to the skin. They can actually burn the eyes and skin. An average beauty supply shop in Dakar has many kinds of skin lightening creams and soaps. Shop worker Adama Jane advises her visitors to avoid the stronger products that promise fast results. She uses a cream that is made from carrots and not the strong chemical hydroquinone. She says that it is a personal choice and that no one pressures her. She says that some women want to be black every day, but for her, she likes to be a shade of brown. Women in Senegal say they lighten their skin for the same reasons women all over the world make changes to their appearances. They say they want to look beautiful, to find a husband, or to stand out in a crowd. But some products are so strong, they must be mixed with others before they are used. One such soap is called Day Before the Wedding. This thinking troubles Senegalese filmmaker Hardiata Pouye Sall. So she made This Color That Bothers Me, a film about the subject of skin lightening.
I used
the most shocking images so that women would see the dangers. It is hard to understand why a woman would tell herself that dark skin is not beautiful. It is in their heads. They want to please a man to be loved, or they want to please society to succeed.
Ms. Saul says the government needs to better control the marketing and sale of skin lighteners. But she adds education is the best way to persuade people against using them. I'm Ana Mateo.
This is Shirley Griffith.
And this is Steve Ember with the VOA Special English Program, Explorations. Today we tell about an important American river, the Missouri. It is the longest river in the United States.
The first American Indians to live along the Missouri River called the river the Minnesosi. It means the muddy river. Even today, the Missouri is called the Big Muddy by many people. This is because it carries huge amounts of dirt from the land through which it flows. The dirt makes the river a brown color for much of its length. The Missouri begins in the Rocky Mountains of North America. It is formed by three rivers that come together in what is the north-central state of Montana. The three rivers are the Jefferson, Madison, and Gallatin rivers. They become the Missouri River in the southwestern part of Montana, more than 1,200 meters above sea level. The river is clear and flows rapidly as it begins its travels east and south. It moves more slowly as it flows down to the waters of the Mississippi River, about 10 kilometers north of the modern-day city of St. Louis. The Missouri travels 4,000 kilometers from the high mountains in the north to the lowlands of the south. It flows along the borders of seven states: Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, and finally Missouri.
The first Europeans who reported seeing the river were at the mouth of the Missouri, where it empties into the Mississippi. They were French explorers Jacques Marquette and Louis Joliet. In 1673, they were traveling down the Mississippi in a small wooden boat when they heard a great noise of water moving at great speed. Father Marquette wrote that he felt great fear. He saw large trees floating into the Mississippi River. They were carried in violently moving muddy water. The muddy water was the Missouri River, which emptied into the western side of the Mississippi. The Missouri was a violent river, making travel along it difficult. Yet explorers and settlers used it as a way to move west. In the early 1700s, French fur traders began to travel along the Missouri to the lands of the great American West.
The first non-natives to explore the river, from its mouth to its beginnings, did so in 1805 and 1806. President Thomas Jefferson sent Meriwether Lewis and William Clark to explore the area. The United States government had bought from France a large area of land called the Louisiana Territory. This land extended from the Gulf of Mexico northwest to the Pacific coast. The story of Lewis and Clark's travels up the Missouri River and on to the Pacific Northwest is one of the great stories of American exploration. President Jefferson sent the two men to explore the little-known river to learn all about the land on both sides of it. Lewis and Clark completed the trip in 2 years. The explorers were the first Americans to cross the Missouri lands to the Pacific Northwest.
Lewis and Clark brought back to Washington a detailed report about the plants, trees, animals, and climate they found on their travels. Many different scientists have long studied these facts. The two men also returned with a lot of information about the different Indian nations of the West. Since then, the Indian names have become well known through the many stories and books written about them. The Mandans, the Nez Perce, the Sioux, the Blackfeet, the Chickasaws, the Pawnees, and the Crows were some of these nations. Most of the Indians Lewis and Clark met along the way were a great help to them. One of the most famous was a woman named Sacajawea. She was a Shoshone Indian who had been captured by the Mandan tribe. The two explorers knew that the Shoshone Indians, who lived near the Rocky Mountains, had good horses. Since the two explorers began their trip, they had been traveling up the Missouri River by boat. They knew that they would need horses to help them in the next part of their exploration over land. So Lewis and Clark took Sacajawea with them. She could help them deal with the Shoshone tribe when they left the river and crossed over the tall, rough mountains. Today, the image of Sacajawea is on the American dollar coin. It honors her part in helping Lewis and Clark explore what became the Western United States.
Soon after Lewis and Clark explored the territory, settlers began moving west along the Missouri River. They began their western travels on boats that took them from St. Louis to either Kansas City or St. Joseph in western Missouri. Then they took wagons to Oregon and California on the coast of the Pacific Ocean. It was the Missouri River that started them on their way to new homes in new lands. A large part of the river became the border between two kinds of land and two ways of life. On the east side were beautiful woodlands and lakes. On the west side were great open plains stretching all the way to the high western Rocky Mountains.
The two sides of the river were different when the first European explorers traveled the Missouri. On the east side of the river, the explorers found Indian woodsmen living in tents hidden among trees. These tribes hunted deer. They fought their enemies by surprise attacks from hidden places. On the west side of the river, the explorers found strong Indian buffalo hunters and fighters on horses. These Indians attacked out in the open and wanted no cover to protect themselves, only the backs of racing horses. There are similar differences today. On the eastern side of the Missouri are farms and tall corn. On the western side are horses and cows and cowboys.
It is said that you need to look in the middle of the Missouri River to find where the American West begins. The state of Missouri is in the center of the United States. It is named after the great river that flows from west to east through its center. The city of Independence is in the western part of the state. It is considered the geographical center of the continental United States. One of the city's most famous citizens was Harry Truman, who was the 33rd President of the United States. He was president from 1945 until 1953. When he left office, Truman returned to his home in Independence on the shores of the Missouri River.
For many years after Lewis and Clark's exploration, only fur traders used the river to carry the goods they wanted to sell. They carried their furs in small boats that were light on the water and did not hit the bottom. Beginning in 1830, the American Fur Company began to use steamboats to carry goods up and down the Missouri. This trade began to disappear in 1859. It was then that a railroad was completed between Hannibal on the Mississippi River in the east and St. Joseph on the Missouri River in the western part of the state of Missouri. It was easier to move goods and people by train.
After World War II ended, the United States government approved a major plan to develop the areas along the Missouri River. The plan included flood control and development along the river. Now a series of six huge dams in the middle area of the river control the flow of the Missouri. More than 100 smaller dams are on smaller rivers that flow into the Missouri. The dams contain the water from the melting snows in the north. Today, boats continue to carry goods and people up and down the Missouri River, as they have for centuries.
This special English program was written by Oliver Chandler and produced by Paul Thompson. Our audio engineer was Holly Capehart. This is Steve Ember.
And this is Shirley Griffith. Join us again next week for another Explorations program on the Voice of America.